Well, today we have just finished up with the seven bold judgments. And so the end is near soon. Jesus will come back, at least in Revelation terms. And what John does here is he interrupts the flow. He does a little parenthetical analysis of the city of Babylon, and it really got me thinking. Can you think of maybe some famous cities throughout history that were the center of political and cultural power? Do we have any cities like that in the U.S.? To a certain extent, but isn't it interesting that in the U.S., we have New York as kind of the center of financial power. Where's the political power concentrated? Washington, D.C. And where's the cultural power trend? L.A. So we really have three influential cities for the most part, okay? But what are some, can you think of maybe just some cities where the culture, the politics, and the economic power is all centered and concentrated? Chicago. Well, Chicago, not for the U.S., but Rome would be one, right? You look at the Roman Empire, I mean, all of it was built around Rome. The power was in Rome, the wealth was directed to Rome, the culture, more or less, came from Rome. Can you think of maybe some other famous cities that were kind of the center of power? Cairo. Berlin would be one, yeah, for the Third Reich. Yeah. Maybe London would be one for the British Empire. Moscow in Russia. You look at Nineveh for the Assyrian Empire. You look at Babylon for the Babylonian Empire. And so when we're looking at Babylon, I think in the U.S. we kind of struggle with, you know, there's no real one great city. Because we really have three cities that really contain all the influence. But in the biblical times when this was being written, I mean, what was the city of all cities? It was Rome, right? It was Rome. I mean, that was the center of the world, the saying, all roads lead to Rome. And so during this tribulation period, we learn about another city. This is Babylon. Now, whether or not it's actually Babylon located in the same city, I mean, it could be, but I think that the spirit of all this is that there's just a one city in the midst of all the destitution and all the poverty. There's one city that rises out of the ashes. I was doing a little research today. Do you know what city has the most billionaires on earth? Was that? No, nope, not Dubai. What did it say, John? Not Geneva, no. Tokyo. It's Moscow. Moscow has 79 billionaires, which is interesting because the average income for somebody who lives in for a worker in Moscow per year is $17,000. And so that's inflated, obviously, because of billionaires. And you go to Russia, and Russia is not a rich country. I mean, you have a lot of people who live in destitution and poverty, but you just have these very wealthy, influential people. In fact, Moscow is the fourth most expensive city for an expatriate to live in. It's an high property values, high-end retail, everything. And so you have this poor country in general, and all of the wealth is concentrated in one city. And so you see in Revelation, there's destitution because of the poverty, the death, the destruction. Yet in the midst of all of this, there still is one glorious city, one tribute, kind of a symbol of hope, if you will, that if I can just get to Babylon, I will be happy. If I can just get to Babylon, everything will be okay. It's just a celebration of the reward of humanity. Does that make sense? There, And I think there's, I mean, we have different venues where people just think, if I can just get invited to the Playboy Mansion. If I just, I mean, actually, there's a U2 song about this. If I could just get into the Playboy Mansion, then I will have a ride. If I can just get that penthouse over Central Park, I would have made it. If I can get that home in Beverly Hills. I mean, so there's almost this ideal associated with these cities and with this locale. And I think that's what we find in Babylon. It's just the center of the world. It's the hope of humanity. It's where you go to make it big. And so when we look at Babylon, we really see two tales of Babylon. And we've talked about this idea of recapitulation. Remember how you have Genesis 2 and Genesis 3? It's the same story told from different perspectives. Now, some people will say that Babylon is actually talking about two separate cities, but it's really the same city. There's a lot of overlap. Chapter 17 refers to a city, and there's so much overlap. It's really the same thing, and it's a tale told in two ways. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at Revelation chapter 17, and we're going to look at this creature of Babylon, and there's this, and Babylon is more than a city, it represents a lot more, and I think we will see that all that the world has to offer will ultimately be destroyed, because when you do befriend Babylon, when you befriend all that it entails and represents and the lofty ideals, you will get burned in the end. So let me go ahead and we'll read chapter 17, verses 1 through 2, and we'll just kind of comment as we go along. It says, "Then one of the seven angels who had seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, 'Come here, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of immorality.'" So what do we see? I mean, what do we see here? Let's put on our observation glasses. What does John lay his eyes upon? What's he about to see? City that sits on a lot of waters. Yeah, Babylon, if you know much about ancient Near Eastern history, actually sits on the Euphrates River, and there's a bunch of dikes and canals. In fact, Babylon was conquered by the Medes because they actually drained the Euphrates and they were able to get into the city that way. So when it talks about a city on many waters, that's just another way of saying Babylon. In fact, Jeremiah 51:13 talks about Babylon, "O you who dwell by many waters." So it's a reference to that ancient city. Okay, what else do we see? How is it described? Look at verse 1.
Described as a great harlot,
okay. Now, you look at a further elaboration of this great harlot in verse 2. What do we see there? Okay.
How does a king commit that sort of an act of the city?
Acts of immorality. Okay.
Is this where world rulers went?
Mm-hmm. Well, keep in mind, this was, and we'll develop this a little bit more. I mean, Babylon was the cultural, political, well, it will be the cultural, political, and economic hub. And so if you want to get anywhere in life, you have to make it big in Babylon. So there's a derived authority here. Now you look at this idea of harlotry, and there's a couple options here. When you think about harlotry, what type of harlotry could this be? Okay. There's a little transaction going on. Okay. So that would be one, kind of a economic transaction. Okay, what would be another one? What would be another possibility? Like a lot of times when we hear harlotry used in the Bible, how's it used? whoring after other gods. So there could be maybe a religious harlotry that's going on. So a lot of the commentaries are divided on this. Now, the issue is when you talk about spiritual prostitution, if it was Jerusalem, you can make that case. Because that is supposed to be consecrated and devoted towards the living God. So it going after other gods is very common. But this is actually a pagan city that's committing harlotry. I mean, it doesn't really even pretend to be faithful to God to begin with. So what type of harlotry do they have in mind here? Well, here's a little quote I have at the very bottom of page 111. It says, since the harlot of the apocalypse is a pagan city, it is more likely that a passage like Nahum 3:4 or Isaiah 23:16-17 supplies an immediate background. In the form of the harlot is Nineveh, who betrays the nations with her harlotries and her charms. Isaiah pictures Tyre as a forgotten harlot. In the context of Revelation 17 and 18, the image is not that of a religious profligacy, but of the prostitution of all that is right and noble for the questionable ends of power and luxury. So what you have to keep in mind here is it's really a corruption. It's a transaction. You look at, let's say, an African ruler. Okay, African rulers, I mean, you'll have like Mobutu Sese Seko. I think he was the president of the Congo. I could be wrong, but he was... Yeah, a multi-billionaire in a country where people lived on $200 a year. And he just had this elaborate, ornate palace. I think it was Zaire. Zaire is where he was. And for him to keep his power, there's kind of this clientele type of thing where he's able to kind of buy off the top layer. I mean, he was committing... harlotry. I mean, they were committing harlotry. They were betraying their own people to get a little extra kickback from Mobutu Sese Seko. And that was just a way he kind of controlled them. It's kind of like the, you know, a lot of those kings, everyone's living in destitution, but the kings will just sell their souls. They will ignore doing right. They'll ignore justice and their duty before God so that they can get a little kickback, whether it's power, pleasure, or whatever. Does that make sense? And so that's really what Babylon is representing. It's a very corrupting entity that is really attracting the kings, having them surrender what is right and just to achieve their own ends. So in a similar sense, here's a little thought question. I mean, what entities are people in the world quick to run to in times of trouble? What does this demonstrate about the relationship with God, and why might this be considered harlotry? What was that? The UN? Okay, sure. Government. Okay, now government might be... Well, let maybe kind of develop that a little bit more. What do you mean by running to the government in times of trouble?
I don't know, FEMA or welfare.
Okay. And what do they hope to get out of the government? Bailout, handout, yeah. Yeah, so their faith would be in the government to deliver them, okay? As opposed to God, that, yeah, they are to bail me out, they're to deliver me. Okay, what else are, what are some other things that people might run to in times of trouble? Yeah, Adam. Mm-hmm.
I'm desperate, therefore, it's okay for me to smash the window with a store and steal.
Okay. Take matters into their own hands by sinning against God and stealing. Okay, what else? You know... Yeah, they do. They hope that it'll get them out of a jam, not for the right reasons, but for the wrong ones. And that's absolutely right. We forget about that. There's a lot of false religions out there that have plenty of adherents.
Self-help gurus.
Mm-hmm. Self-help. They turn to the power within. Other things that people might turn to? What about some of the vices? Drugs. Sex. Gambling. I mean, and what's the allure of those things? Easy escapes, kind of creating alternate realities. And so you see that there's, you look at the political power, you look at, let's say, the wealth. I mean, sometimes people double down and think, if I can make a lot of money, I can get out of this issue. You look at the pleasure. All those things really are attractive to a lot of people, and they want to run to those things as opposed to God. And that's really harlotry. Look at that verse, James 4:4. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. And so people go to the world because they think, if I can just get into that Playboy mansion, if I can just win the lottery, if I can just be elected to that position, then I will have it made. Okay, so there's just this ideal, this pursuit. If I can just get to those things, then I will be happy. Yeah, Mark.
We can carry it actually to ourselves. If we could just get our house paid for, we could just,
yep.
I mean, that could be an idol in itself.
Yeah.
Just get that house on the hill, like live in the country.
Yeah, it's a source of hope. Because you look at the tribulation, I mean, these people are really suffering. What hope do they have? Do you know what I'm saying? Babylon is their hope. It is their hope. Maybe I can go to Babylon and make it big there. And so the kings, all of them, are reaching out to this city. So Babylon is not merely a commercial center. It's a cultural hotbed with a glamorous lifestyle facilitated by abundant wealth. The rest of the world envies this hedonistic indulgence, and thus they become drunk with the wine of immorality. Now, why do you suppose there's such a strong correlation between wealth and hedonism? Excess? Okay, you want to develop that a little bit more?
Well, I mean, I think our nature is to indulge ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And wealth just gives you the mechanism by which to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Tiger Woods, yeah. Yeah, and Tiger Woods is kind of an interesting case because you look at him, I mean, he had everything the world could want. I mean, he had his own island, didn't he? And beautiful wife. He had commercial appeal, a lot of wealth, and yet he had these self-destructive tendencies. Because it wasn't quite enough. And I think that's a lot of it. People make it big, and then it's like, well, this is terrible. What do I do now? Hey, other thoughts on the relationship between wealth and hedonism? Yeah.
The sycophants that come along with it that'll keep telling you how great you are so you get a piece of the action.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, what gets you there and all those things definitely accentuates it. Yeah, for sure.
Well, you always want fulfillment, love, you know, hedonism.
Uh-huh.
Self-desire. We all have the mindset of more money will give you that self-desire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being empty.
Yeah. And so you just see they're just drunk with immorality. Have another drink. The world's going to fall apart tomorrow. Eat, drink, and be merry. That was going on in Babylon. Okay, so kind of moving on, you guys kind of tracking with me here. I mean, Babylon's a real entity, but it represents a lot more, okay? And even though we can't necessarily see it in America, there's many places in this world, like if you're a Russian, you go to Moscow. That's the place to be. That's where all the great people are. That's where the elites are located. Verse 3, and he carried me away in the wilderness, in the spirit, into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads and 10 horns. So what does he see here? Observation skills. What do you see? Yeah, Adam. Just describe it. Not a trick question.
Well, a woman sitting on a red beast with 7 heads, 10 horns, and somehow full of names of blasphemy.
Okay. Now, does this remind you of anything in Revelation? The dragon, that's right. Remember, if we go back to 13:1, and a dragon stood on the sand of the seashore, then I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on the horns were 10 diadems, and on the heads were blasphemous names. Okay, so This is a further elaboration of what we saw earlier. And so you see, where's the woman positioned? She's riding on it, okay? And so the imagery here is that Babylon, this wicked, adulterous city, is ascending to power by riding on the back of this beast with seven heads and 10 horns and blasphemous names. Now, we'll talk more about the details a little bit later. But basically, this Babylon, the harlot, is ascending to power with the Antichrist empire. Why do you think the Antichrist would allow for Babylon to rise? What do you think? Okay, more people for him to have. Okay. Yeah.
He's given anyone who wants to trade has to take the mark. Anyone who takes the mark is condemned.
So uh-huh.
If Babylon's the commercial center.
Yeah. And I think that's dead on. I mean, a good insight, Adam. Did you hear that? Remember how one of the ways that he procures worshipers is you have to take the mark of the beast. And if you don't take the mark of the beast, you cannot trade or engage in commercial transactions. And so if you have one city that is the commercial center of the whole world, you can facilitate all those things. I mean, what are some other things that the Antichrist and the false prophet try to promote? Remember the other thing that he was making them do? Bow down to idols, particularly what kind of idol? Yeah, remember the image of the beast, and he had to bow down before it. And so it was much easier to kind of centralize all that worship in one place. And so when you have one dominant, influential city, I mean, you think about the British Empire. If you control London, you basically control the British Empire. You control Rome, you control the Roman Empire, agreed? To a certain extent. And so Babylon, because it's all centered in Babylon, the Antichrist could effectively rule over all the nations, over all the world from it. Because where did the ten kings get their authority? They got it from Babylon. Okay? So you see how this is set up. Now we see the details of the woman in 4 through 6a. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of unclean things of her immorality. And on her head a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And so you see her attire. She's dressed in scarlet and purple. And scarlet and purple, back in those days, I mean, that was a cat's meow. I mean, that's like wearing mink. Is mink still fashionable? You guys all remember. I mean, you were in the. I mean, now because of PETA and stuff like that, you'll get it spray painted. But back in the 40s and 50s, you had a mink coat. I mean, it said something about you, okay? And so she's wearing scarlet and purple. We also see that even in the midst of all this poverty, she had expensive jewelry. And so, I mean, can you just imagine this? I mean, people who are starving in the streets or losing everything, they're looking on their TV and they're looking at their latest celebrity who's all dressed up, wearing ostentatious attire. Now, how will this woman's wealth strengthen, or the Babylon's wealth strengthen her grip on the world?
And they view her as the one that's going to give them what they need.
Yeah.
She has the wealth, she has the beauty.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she's all, yeah, and that's just it. I mean, she has what they want. You look at Hollywood. I mean, what do people want? They want to look like the Hollywood actresses or actors. They want to live like the Hollywood actors and actresses. They want to have the influence of them as well. I mean, people are drawn to them. It's almost like they will live vicariously through their favorite actor or singer or whoever. And so you see, in her hand, she has a golden cup. Now, it's kind of like her. It's It's beautiful on the outside, but on the inside it's full of abominations and unclean things. Indeed, Babylon will be a radiant, beautiful city, but full of debauchery and indulgence. People from all around will be drawn to her on account of her beautiful image, but once there, they will be deceived into a decadent descent. Now, can you think of any modern equivalents to Babylon luring people with a promise of pleasure only to destroy them? There's an obvious one. You better get it. Las Vegas, right? What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Can you imagine having a pastor's conference in Vegas? I mean, how? That's like the worst idea on the planet, right? The Shepherd's Conference in Las Vegas this year. And the MGM Grand. I mean, we'll have magic shows and make sure you bring some money for the entertainment. I mean, it just doesn't work, right? So that'd be one. I mean, Vegas is, and you look at Vegas, I mean, what does Vegas mean to America?
It's Sin City.
Sin City, yeah. I mean, isn't Vegas just an ideal? It's iconic. Yeah, but it does have an iconic appeal, doesn't it? I'm not saying in a good way, I'm just stating the reality. I mean, what does Vegas represent to people? Why do people want to go to Vegas? Why do they dream of going to Vegas? Good times, you have easy money, you have strip clubs, you have provocative shows, you have the promise of wealth, you have all these ostentatious buildings, you have the buffets, I mean, sex, gluttony, gambling, opulence, and then the other thing that you have is secrecy. Whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And so people think, if I can just get to Vegas, and it's so interesting, being that I'm on Facebook, I can look in on the lives of all my friends. It's just going to Vegas, and you have 100 comments. You know, oh, I'm so happy for you. We won't tell anyone what you do. And, you know, wink, wink, and all this lingo and language. But, yeah, I think Vegas is definitely has that Babylonian appeal to it. Okay, so that might be one city. Other cities?
Hollywood.
Yeah, what does Hollywood represent?
Glamour.
Yeah.
Try and make it big. Mm-hmm. Star, but in the meantime, there's the casting couch.
Yep. Hey, you're just saying it like it is. I mean,
so
and it's true.
People that's going for the one ticket, I get to Hollywood, if I make it, I'm there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
and as someone who, I mean, my kids were born in Hollywood, I ministered in Burbank, best-looking waiters on the planet were in Burbank. I mean, and you knew their story. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from Indiana. Let me guess. And they're here to make it big. And I've seen many of them, counseled many of them. They're beautiful, but there's just a real emptiness there. Other cities that kind of come to mind?
New Orleans.
Yeah, it was really interesting when Hurricane Katrina took out New Orleans. Everybody at our church in Burbank were saying, yeah, well, no wonder God judged that city. And then we thought, well, wait a second. We live in Burbank. We live right next to Hollywood. All the studios are right down the street from us. And there's Earthquake Central, okay? So we kind of held off on the... You know, pious, well, that city, it never happened there. How about Daytona Beach? Panama City. I mean, there's just locales that we have that are synonymous with this Babylonian ideal of pleasure. You look at New York. I mean, New York, you talk to somebody who's from New York, and they think that the whole country revolves around New York, that there's a superior breed of people there, where they're Ivy League. They made it big. They're elite. They're not like the country bumpkins in Kansas. I mean, so that draws power brokers. You look at people moving to Washington, D.C., because they want to rise to political power. I mean, there's so many cities out there where their location is synonymous with power and pleasure, and prosperity. And here you have Babylon, where it's all conflated into one city. And people are drawn to this city. And it has this corrupting influence on everyone. And so you see the name. The name in verse 5 is Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Now, Babylon the Great, I have a little note here. Babylon is the ancient city in which people sought to extol the virtues of man. God quashed their efforts when he destroyed the Tower of Babel. Regardless, Babylon remained a great and powerful metropolis, home to multiple empires. Though great in man's sight, Babylon has often been an enemy of God and his people. In the future, Babylon will be associated with the worldwide political and commercial system established by the Antichrist. In this case, Babylon most likely refers to the central city of the empire with its leaders and citizens who exert influence over all over the planet. The name Babylon reveals the sinister makeup, and they take the name of the traditional city which opposes God. Then you have the mother of harlots and the abomination of the earth. No doubt this points to the corrupting influence of this debauched city. As the kings of the earth come to her, they take her culture home with them. Now, how is corrupt culture spread in our day? The media. Yeah. Now, what was really interesting when I was in Hungary for a couple years, I was amazed at how all of the movies, all of the television shows, I mean, by far the most popular television show in Hungary was Baywatch. They all wanted to watch it. They actually had a Baywatch European tour where the stars would sing and perform songs. I mean, people loved that show, and it was made in the U.S. They loved all the movies that came from the U.S. They would watch MTV and all the music videos, and it became clear to me that the most influential cultural city on the planet is really Los Angeles. Not even close to anything else. And so you see that Babylon is just exporting all of the sensuality and the idolatry. It's just coming from this cultural hotbed. I'm using all these modern equivalents so you could see that everything that we have right now is ratcheted up to an even greater extent in that tribulation period. It's just a wicked, evil, debauched city. Okay, and then John does some deciphering for us. Okay, any questions about this? Is this kind of...
Is the sign literally on her head, or is that...
In the vision, it would be. I mean, this whole thing that he sees is a symbolic vision. So, yeah, he sees a vision of her riding that dragon or riding that beast, but that stands for more of a literal reality. Does that make sense? So he's seeing a vision here. Okay,
so
yeah.
What he actually sees is what it says.
Yeah, that's what he sees. Because he comes up and he's seeing this vision. I mean, this whole thing that John sees is a vision. He's not actually engaged in time travel here, where he's actually in the future, but he sees a vision of the future, which God decrees and declares. Okay, good question, though. Okay, 6b. When I saw her, I wondered greatly. And the angel said to me, "Why do you wonder? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will wonder when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. And they are 7 kings, 5 have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. The beast, which was and is not, is himself also the 8th, and is one of the 7. He goes to destruction. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. Yet these have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. Okay, does that make sense? Notice how it says, he who has wisdom, let him hear. Okay, so basically, I'll kind of write down some of the things that we see. Okay, we see that the seven heads correspond to the seven mountains that the woman sits, which also corresponds to the seven kings. And we see an elaboration. There were five that were, one that is, and then one that is to come. And there's kind of a mystery where this becomes the seventh and the eighth, okay? Now, the seven heads, remember when we looked at the dragon in Revelation chapter 13? There were seven heads. And remember what the dragon was doing? He was persecuting the Jewish people. And what we did is we kind of extrapolated back to the five nations that persecuted the Jews. Can you name the first nation that comes to mind?
Egypt,
right? And then after Egypt, you have Assyria, then
Babylon,
then
Medo-Persia,
and Greece. Are you looking in the... Okay, that's like, John, you're on top of it, Mark. And then I see you have a study Bible. Way to go. All right. So you have... Well, when you mispronounced Medo-Persia, I knew that there was something going on, okay? So you had the five past ones. Okay, then what's the current one here? But in the context of John writing this, it's Rome, right? And then, so that's the one that is, and then the one that is to come would be the future Roman/Babylonian Empire, okay? So you have the seven kings and the seven mountains. That really refers, they're one and the same. So that refers to the realms that are really empowered by the satanic force. Okay, so the fact that there's seven heads on one dragon, on one beast, and we have the seven-headed dragon. Remember, it's a dragon that wanted to slay Jesus. It's a dragon that was persecuting the Jews. That really speaks of the satanic influence. Now, another thing that we read about is that there is one who was not, and is. Now, any guesses as to what that could be? Yeah.
The beast and the Antichrist.
Beast and the Antichrist. Now, what do you mean? What do you think it means? It was not, and is.
Killed
and then resurrected. Okay. Now you look at 7 and 8, where it's really the same person who was and is not and then is. See, a lot of people speculate, I tend to agree with them, that perhaps after the resurrection, that the Antichrist himself is fully empowered and possessed by Satan. Because what's the origin of this beast? It comes from, what's the word? Where does the beast come from? Look at the text. What was that? No, in verse 17. Now look at verse 8.
The abyss.
Can you think of other things that come from the abyss? Remember, those demon locusts, they came from the abyss. Okay, so it implies a satanic origin. So this beast is coming out of the abyss, has a satanic origin, and so this is probably a reference to the first half of the tribulation. He's the Antichrist, he's the beast. Second half, after he's resurrected, he's empowered by Satan himself, which could explain a lot of the supernatural miracles and other things that he's able to accomplish. Does that make sense? Trying to help it make sense. Mark, you following it? I mean, you always have the study Bible to fall back on, but that's why we have it. All right. And so now we're going to look at, and the other thing that you see is you see that the Antichrist is able to perform great signs and wonders. Let's see. Yeah, the world will wonder when they see the beast. They'll be filled with wonder. I'm sorry. So you have these unregenerate people who are going to be very thoroughly impressed by the Antichrist. Now, why do you think he's going to have such sway over them? Rose from the dead. Yeah, I mean, it'll... Mm-hmm. But what do you think will protect the believers from following him? They know the truth. I think about John 16:13. But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you in all truth. So God will not allow the truly saved, the elect, to fall away. And so now we kind of move on to the judgment of the great harlot. Okay, any questions? Are you guys kind of tracking with this? Is kind of making sense? I know it's a lot of decoding that's going on. Yeah. Well, the ten kings are probably part of the last empire that actually are probably, like, you look at how Rome was structured. You had the central empire, and an empire is basically a conglomeration of kingdoms. So all the kings pay tribute to the emperor. So in this case, I forgot to give that detail. Thanks for asking. The ten kings get their power from Babylon. The ten kings are the ten kings of the ten regions of the world that are all under the dominion of the Antichrist. Okay, is that making sense? So you see how all of this is so fascinating to kind of study this world and see how all of these things can indeed happen. I mean, you see the seed forms of it already. Although the European Union may not be one of the kingdoms, since it's slowly falling apart right now. But we see the overthrow. You see in 15 through, we'll do 18. It says, and he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. For God has put in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of the God will be fulfilled. The woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Okay, so what do we see here?
So are they saying that she's Babylon?
Yeah, that she's Babylon. Mm-hmm. So the woman would be Babylon. But what happens to the great city in this passage? She falls apart. And why is that? What was that? They're overthrown by the beast and, yeah, turned upon her. And by who else? Yeah, by the ten kings, right? And ultimately by God. I mean, Tia, I mean, she, you know, God uses these things, you know, because God has put it in their heart. So you see God working through wicked people to accomplish his purpose. And so, again, you see the identity. The angel further elaborates on the waters. As water freely flowed in and out of the ancient city of Babylon, so does the city's influence on peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Such comprehensive commercial and cultural control by one city is difficult to imagine, but it's clear from this verse that the world looks to Babylon. And then you see the overthrow of Babylon. And we're not quite sure what motivates this. I mean, God put it in their heart. It might be out of jealousy of her wealth, popularity. The ten kings and the beast will turn on Babylon and will hate and destroy this city. And this is described in verse 16, that make her desolate and naked. This implies plundering the great city, then humiliating all of its inhabitants. Will eat her flesh. This describes the spilling of blood as the armies attack the citizens of this prosperous metropolis. Will burn her up with fire. All of the banks, businesses, factories, etc. will be consumed with fire as the armies of the Antichrist will ensure the city will never prosper again. And so really what comes to mind is is Jesus foretells of this in Mark 3:22-23:26. He said this, "And he called them to himself and began speaking to them in parables. How can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. If Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but he is finished." So here's a question. Why is Satan's empire so unstable? Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's based off of deceit and corruption and what you did to achieve power. You just assume that everybody else is doing the same thing too. Any other thoughts? Can you think of maybe some other examples of a kingdom turning on itself?
Power struggles?
What's that?
I was going to relate with that power struggle, but when you get gluttonous, flesh, Satan comes out.
Uh-huh.
The fall of Roman Empire was all due to the fact of their prosperity and gluttonous. And
yep.
Sin entered into their nobility.
Yep.
Take a look at our country, we're fat and gluttonous.
Yeah, I mean, the order of... When people become gluttonous and filled with pleasure, the individual's happiness is more important than the stability of society. Do you see what I'm saying? You look at when society breaks down, it's every man for himself. And you can see how that impulse is probably happening. I mean, one idea that comes to mind is you look at Gideon. Do you remember how he beat the Midianites? What happened? They turned on each other out of fear, yeah. And so in this time, impending judgment is coming. They're increasingly desperate. They're not quite sure what else to do. They can't necessarily attack God. God's protecting the remnant of believers and Jews. And so basically the Jews, I'm not sure if the believers are protected, but in the desert, the Jews are protected. And so they turn on each other and they engage in warfare. And the other thing that's really interesting is you see God's sovereignty here, right? For God had put it in their hearts to execute his purpose. What do you think of that passage? I mean, what's God's role in all this? I mean, what does it explain about why he allowed the Antichrist and those 10 kings to exist? Yeah, for his purpose. The only reason why Satan is... one of the great...